age in which we are living in. We are surrounded by events so enormous and so fraught with archetypal significance that it's everything that we can do barely to keep up, to keep afloat. And we're very much like those passengers of the Titanic who, having watched the ship and all those other courageous souls go down, realize that we are just in rowboats, alone on the face of the cold deep, and our late 20th century consciousness is strained almost beyond compare. And it comes as a shock of recognition to realize that this travail of the ages, happened at least once before. And from the crest of the wave of our anxiety, we look back across the millennia and we see on a par with us, on a crest of another titanic wave of anxiety, those human beings who lived about 2,000 years ago, and we feel a great affinity with those human beings, those men and women, the lives that they were forced to live, that they had to live, like we have to live. We have to find ways every day to live. And we have all experienced the utter gross futility of trying to plan according to anything less than the real. That there is no political or metaphysical or emotional or mental template which we can put upon the very ambiguous parenthetical qualities of our lives other than the real. And we will settle for nothing less than truth. We can't. We can't no longer live according to partialities. And so we look back, almost one great Platonic year back, and we see that there were human beings that suffered as we are suffering now. The most poignant focus of that age was Jesus. It seems that there was a alchemical change that happened. And if you, as we have done at another place that I teach, Whirling Rainbow, take a whole year and patiently over 50 lectures, over 100 hours, trace decade by decade, sometimes year by year, person by person, the events from about 200 BC to about 150 AD, one sees a sea change, a transformation on a colossal scale. That in the BC years, the travail is one of expectant wonderment, hoping that one understands what is coming, hoping that the old traditional wisdoms will hold true. And then it's almost as if a trigger has been pulled and a split has occurred. And the vast majority of human beings suffer disillusionment that nothing is going to happen, that everything is going to unwind. Everything has become demonic. And then there's a small growing group who realize that there has been some basic qualitative change, that the real has emerged, but that its emergence is so radically new, so startlingly different from what they thought it might be, that they're having to live with the newness, with the freshness, to get used to a new universe. That the old universe had star patterns, constellations, which were recognizable as far back as man's memory and tradition could go, and now it was different. Now, instead of constellations, the heavens were a unity. Or to use Ficino's Renaissance Florentine word, a unitas, that all of the several constellations had become one heaven, that all of the Ten Commandments had become one new commandment, that there had been a reconciliation on a massive scale, on a structural scale, that had never been seen before and has never been seen since. This bifurcation of massive disillusionment and a small spiritual minority who understood that something had changed, but that they were going to have to live lives in this newness, this freshness, in order to discover what it might be. And their greatest concern was for the return of the Master, because the change had happened because of him. There was no doubt. And when he comes back, he'll help us. And it slowly dawned over the first 100 years that they're expecting him to come back again like he was a regressive backsliding into old bad habits, that expecting him to come back as he was not understanding the newness, the freshness, the change. And it slowly occurred to him that he had never left, that that was what was fresh, that was what was new about the universe, that one no longer had to expect a manifestation in particular, like a Son of God, but that the universe was a whole, that he was everywhere there from here on out. And this took some acclimation. The biggest drawback was the mind, the psyche of man. We have never had problems with our physicality. That's not a problem. All of us can grow up. All of us can learn to control ourselves. All of us can learn to give ourselves, our bodies, our lives away for those that we love, that they might live. That's no problem. The mind, the psyche, that's the problem. And it's this psychic mental overlay that had become so problematic in the BC centuries as to haunt the known world by a demonic fog. And in the AD centuries, slowly it was understood that the angelic hierarchies were helpers in a way that had not been understood before. It was naively understood before that somehow they were intermediaries from the divine down to man. And now it began to occur to man that they were intermediaries from him on up to the divine. And their function was a protective function to stop the profane from proceeding any further. And that one had to have like a password of purity at that stage of development to be able to go further. And that the classic formulation of that in its most energized rigidity, its most structurally complete sense, was called the Hebdomad, the seven layers, the seven spheres, the planetary spheres. And as long as man was chained to the wheel of destiny, he was astrologically bound in that seven-sphere prison. And it was not the mark of mental cleverness to be able to adjust to that and negotiate according to that. So if one had a horoscope or a chart or a natal situation and had all of the indications and one knew all of this and then could live according to that, that was not the point. The point was to free oneself from that, from the seven levels, so that one was free to go to the eighth, the Ogdoad. The Ogdoad, the liberation from that wheel of destiny. And that eight revealed a ninth, which was hidden, which was so hidden that it was not even understood as long as one were in the mental psychic hierarchies that keep us chained to the mind. That only being freed from that and being fulfilled to that, when that law of deliverance is fulfilled in the eight, then a ninth, the mystical ninth, reveals itself, the unity of all, the unity of all. We have, in our time, an extraordinary array of documents that have been made available to us. And I have a couple of documents here which I would like to refresh us with. One of the most valuable documents is from Philo of Alexandria, who lived roughly from 20 AD to about 20 BC to about 50 AD. Philo of Alexandria, one of the most illustrative and famous families of the day. Philo's brother, named Alexander, and you can imagine now that a Jewish family with a man named Alexander, very Hellenistic, very urbane, very cosmopolitan. In fact, they were one of the richest families in Alexandria. Philo's brother Alexander bankrolled the grandson of Herod the Great when he became governor of Judea. And it's interesting to see the connection between Alexandria and Judea. We can somewhat understand today because we have a very similar kind of a situation. The 2 million Jews in Israel today largely are secure and safe because of the 12 or 13 million American Jews who support them, not just with love, but with finance, also with influence, and make it possible for that to be. Alexandria was like the America of its day. The report was that 1 million Jews lived in Alexandria. The population of Jerusalem was never more than 10,000. Look at the discrepancy. The population. But there was a cultural discrepancy. Because the Jewish population had been fragmented in a very curious way about 600, 700 BC. The Persian influence, the Persian Empire, had come in two broad strokes. The first stroke, they seized the northern Jewish population, Israel, and carried it off into bondage, into exile. And the voice that cried out against that was Isaiah. And in Isaiah, you find the anguish of a people, of a religious psyche being torn apart, being dissolved. And 100 years later, the Persians came back again and completed the job. But this time, the effect was different. The prophetic voice that cried out the second time was Jeremiah. And where Isaiah cries doom, Jeremiah has a lamentation. And a lamentation has a hidden seed of hope that we're going to see this thing through. We are going to purify ourselves by suffering. And whatever it takes, there will come a time when we will return. And it was that second wave of exile that formed the spiritual integrity of the Jewish people. And it was Hilkiah, Jeremiah's father, who along with Ezra put together for the first time the Pentateuch, the Old Testament as we begin to know of it. And it was in this second wave of the exile that the Old Testament became a testament, a collection which one could depend upon if one could only read it and understand that there was a mystery in this. And it was in this exile to Babylonia that the basic sense of spiritual survival in the face of cultural emasculation rose in the Jewish psyche and made of it one of the spiritual treasures of the planet. The exposure not only to the captivity and the exile, but the exposure to their brethren who had been captured before them, 100 years, about 5 generations, enough time to come unraveled. And where did they go? They went into the kind of astrological, mythological schmear that the Persians specialized in. The Persian Empire specialized in making everybody the same pace. And so that second wave in the exile were the root core of those who believed that only inner spiritual purification could save one from the labyrinthian machinations of this world. And later on, when the Greeks replaced the Persians and the Hellenistic power that dwarfed the Persian power came into control, those descendants of the Jeremiah people realized we are in really serious trouble now. And they kept expecting somebody's got to come and replace these Greeks. And the people they expected to replace them were the Romans. Only the real tragic denouement came in the first century BC when the Romans came in and displaced the Greeks, and they were even worse than the Greeks. You think we had problems with the Persians, they said, or the Greeks? The Romans are unbelievable because they don't care anything about the spirit. They want to put legions and roads and laws according to the Roman community mind. The Persian mind was a kind of an ecumenical mind. The Greek mind was an individual mind, but the Roman mind didn't care about individuals at all. It cared about laws, laws of the state, and the ultimate design was not the individual, but those initials, SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanorum, the Senate and the people of Rome. This is what is real. Nobody is real. All roads lead to Rome, and Rome is not a person. It is a massive state of mind. It is an empire. This was the worst. This was absolutely the worst. And by the time Judea had become Romanized, Roman province, through the Maccabean Wars, the building of the Second Temple, but it wasn't a temple like Solomon's temple devoted to wisdom for the individual to understand. The Second Temple was actually profane. It was an empire focus of power, and it had to be challenged. And it wasn't going to be challenged by Romans or Greeks or Persians. It wasn't going to be challenged by those who had been co-opted into these modes of mind. The only people who could challenge that were those small flames of integrity, those individuals who would not be ground up. We will not cooperate with them. And these early groups found an impetus around 106 BC, when a mystical document came out. It's called the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. The traditional understanding was that the temple was to be left to the Levites. those practices. The Testament of the 12 patriarchs meant that the wholeness of the people had to be restored, that all of the 12 tribes had to be restored. And what was interesting was that the restoration of the 12 together meant that there was a common focus, and that common focus increasingly became a person, the Messiah. He is the hub who will not only make this focus happen, but hold this focus together so that this 12 together will become like a wheel of truth instead of a wheel of destiny. And that Messiah, who is the hub of that, will put this unity in motion, and that will be the new law. That will be the new dispensation. The motion of the unity of all of us. And in the first century BC, increasingly, those groups who tried to find a way, what is the rhythm of life of this universe, those Essene peoples, abstracting themselves, trying to purify themselves. And they went into the depths of the Enochian literature. They went into the depths of all of the Hellenistic interpenetrative literature. They went back into the Old Testament, trying to understand what is the structure here, what is the significance. And they found again and again that the cycle, the spiritual cycle, is a cycle of seven, and the square of seven, 49, and the anniversary of the square of seven, which is the 50th day, the Book of Jubilees. The 50th is the Jubilee, but the preparation for it is seven times seven. And they found this is the cycle. This is what is real for us in our spirit. And so they began acclimating their lives, their sacred persons and their lives, as Jefferson would have said. We commit our fortunes, our sacred honor, and our lives to this, because this is what has to be done. And getting used to that for several generations, it took a long while to get in sync with that. And the Essene communities began to grow in spiritual vision. They began to see that the focus of that wheel of the 12 tribes was a presence of someone. Someone. And in lieu of that someone, a teacher of righteousness became apparent. And that teacher of righteousness was not the one, but was a forerunner of the one. The last teacher of righteousness was John the Baptist. He was the best of that 100-year career of the teacher of righteousness, that in human terms of coming from the ground up through purification of one's life from the ground up, he was the best. But he wasn't the one. He was still the clarion call. And he would have passed on that mantle of teacher of righteousness to yet another one, except that in his time, the one came. He was there. He hardly recognized him till he came down by the Essene community, Qumran, there where the Jordan runs into the Dead Sea. He hadn't seen him for 18 years. And he was astounded to see his cousin, Jesus, completely grown, completely open. What had happened? What had gone on? John the Baptist's mother was Elizabeth, sister of Mary, mother of Jesus. They were in an Essene family, an Essene community. They weren't just in the monasteries. The Essenes had branches and members in the cities all through Judea, all through the Jewish population of the late Hellenistic era. But their focus was upon activity, on doing things, on leading the pure life. But there were certain places, like Qumran, and like a certain place outside of Alexandria, just north of Alexandria, right on the coast of Lake Mareotis. And these were the two centers, the two spiritual cyclotrons, as it were, where the practice was raised to the nth power. Well, Mary and Elizabeth, their families, they were Essenes. But when the time came for Mary to give birth to Jesus, because of the tremendous computation going on in terms of this spiritual cycle of 49, it was discovered that this was the time. This was the year. This was the month. This was the day. And this was not just recent speculation. It had been planned for almost 100 years. It had been double-checked. It had been talked about in esoteric circles. And especially in a recursive way, because this is the way truth happens, in a recursive way, that recognition that the time was right had reached all the way back to Babylon, back to the old Persian magi mind. And they were curious. Is it true that they know a computation that is superior to ours? Let's send some emissaries and go and find out. Let's send three of our best. Let's go and find out. Do they know? And on the way, they stopped in to see Herod. And Herod was shocked. He thought these people were kooks. They're just religious people that our people have always had, these fanatics. And here, three of the most powerful of the Persian magi from Babylon have come to check out whether their computations are right. He got scared. He got scared to his bones. Herod actually went insane. He died insane. And a revulsion rose in him that he might be completely overthrown, because he was completely power magnetized. This is what happens to the demonic, becomes power magnetized. That if you let go, that's when you get electrocuted. That's what the power people think. If we let go of control, it's what the ego says. If I let go control of myself, what's going to happen to me? I'm going to be gone. I'm going to die. And it's right. The ego will die. That's the nature of it. If you let go, you lose that life. It's gone. And what comes then is the real. So Herod ordered that all of the male children born within the perimeters of this time computation be killed. That's why there were no babies, baby boys, taken to the temple of Jerusalem in that time period to be consecrated in the temple. It was only a later tradition that said that Mary had taken little baby Jesus to Jerusalem, to the temple, to be consecrated, because you couldn't do it, they would have been killed. Instead, they fled into Egypt. Now, you can't just go into Egypt. It's all desert. You have to go somewhere in Egypt. Especially if you're in an Essene tradition, you have to have your connection, your liaisons, because your way of life has to be continued, because it's in a cycle. You're not living a profane life. You're leading a sacred life, and you're keeping track. They went to Alexandria. And just north of Alexandria, there in Lake Mareotis, was a special community. It was the only one where they were not called Essenes, but they were called Therapeutai, from the Greek meaning therapeia, meaning cure. Let's not even talk about healing. Cure. Healing is returning you back to your nature, but curing is transforming you to your real nature. cure souls. That's what it was. Physicians heal the body, but the therapeutai wanted to cure the soul. And that's what they specialized in. Specialized. It wasn't theory and practice. It was like a speciality. They were like surgeons able to go in and cut through the mind, cut through the psyche, and get to the spirit and bring the spirit out. And when the spirit was brought out, everything else went. And that was the light, bringing that spirit out. And for the first 3 years of his life, the child Jesus was exposed to the community of the therapeutai and to Alexandria. They went back, not to Jerusalem, not to Judea. They went back to Galilee, because the Galileans were separate. They were somewhat looser in their regard. They were not quite under the sway of the power madness of the Jerusalem temple. And in between Galilee and Judea was the province of Samaria. And the Samarians were those Persianized Jews who were no longer Jews, but they were just Hellenistic peoples. In fact, from the Jewish standpoint, a good Samaritan was an odd person. How could you find one? But the curious thing is that in Samaria was the taproot and core of the sacred Jewish tradition. It was a place called Sechem. Sechem. Now, what made Sechem so important was that there was a tremendous well there, not an oasis. There you have to tunnel down through rock 50, 60 feet, 70 feet. And this huge cave tunnel had gone down to this underground river, and it was exposed at that point. That well was the first place that was owned by Abraham. In his caravan route across the Fertile Crescent, Sechem was the final destination. It was the resting place. And that well was finally called Jacob's Well, because he's the father of the 12 tribes. He's that patriarch where the 12 came out from and where they would have to come back together again. Joseph, his son, who was exiled to Egypt, and I'm sure everybody can understand the prototype here, the man who wore the coat of many colors, who understood dream interpretation, when he died in Egypt, beloved of the Pharaoh, his body was brought back and buried there at Sechem. When Joshua, the old Joshua, was addressing, giving his farewell speech to the Hebrew peoples, he gave that speech at Sechem, and a great stone was put there under this oak tree, spreading oak tree. So that Sechem was that place where the very center, the taproot, not Jerusalem, the sacred center was there. This is where it goes down to the underground stream. It was an esoteric center. It was at Sechem that a great confrere meeting happened a couple years after the crucifixion. The disciple Philip was moving through Samaria, and he found himself in Sechem at the same time that Simon Magus was there. And Simon Magus was very, very desirous of finding the secrets of how they cured. He was a very great magician. He knew how to heal, but he didn't know how to cure. He knew how to manipulate things, and he knew how to structure psychic realms, but he was ignorant of the spirit. Teach me, he said, teach me. And Philip, understanding that some great juncture was there, sent word to the apostles. And both Peter and John, St. John and St. Peter, went to fetch him right away. And Philip and Simon Magus and St. John and St. Peter formed a quaternary there at that most sacred place. Simon Peter and Simon Magus and St. John and St. Philip. And they brought together a very peculiar juxtaposition. This notion, this sense of allegorical understanding, of symbolic significance, which we inherit, which we can understand, which is a part of our nature, part of our psyche, is Alexandrian. And it comes there because the very core of that spirituality which we have received was brought together and put together in Alexandria and not in Jerusalem. That Sechem was significant in Alexandrian terms, but not in terms of Jerusalem. So we have to look towards Alexandria, and we have to see that Christ in Alexandria is the key. It's the missing piece whereby the royal arch of wisdom is held together. It's the keystone. That without understanding Christ in Alexandria, we don't have the picture. All we have are like the stones, but they don't make that royal arch of meaning. When he was 12, he was found disputing in the temple. His parents had gone on ahead. They're going back up to Nazareth. They didn't notice that he was not with them for several days because he was used to being off by himself. He's a special child. Let him be. He does this. He's always done this. But they finally noticed after 3 days that he wasn't there. He wasn't anywhere in the caravan. So they turned around and went all the way back, and that's when they found him. He was having a discourse with the elders in the temple, not with boys his own age. And he realized at that time that that was as far as they could go. That the elders in the temple in Jerusalem were like about 12 years old. They were just beginning on adolescence spiritually. That they didn't know. That what they did, they didn't consult themselves like he had been raised, like he understood. They didn't consult themselves. They consulted each other in arguments in terms of the books. That's not real. That's mental. That's being chained for sure. And so he left and he went to Alexandria. Over the next 18 years, blossomed and matured and unfolded to a scale that had never been seen, hasn't been seen. Understood, and we have the descriptions from Philo of the Therapeutic Communion, understood that one has to go into these cycles of purification, and that at the 50th day, one then has a communion, a meal together. In the Therapeutic community, it was bread and a little salt and wine and a little oil. Now, salt is not so much salt like we think of, but salt is a symbol of Sophia, of wisdom, the Holy Spirit. You can't just have the bread, but there has to be a little of the Holy Spirit for its sacredness there. And in the Gospel of Philip, we see also that besides bread and wine, the communion included oil, olive oil usually, or sometimes if it wasn't that, it was what was called hyssop, an herbal liqueur-like. The three brought together in terms of the mystical fourth. This was a part of the therapeutai. This is a part of their cycle. That every Sabbath, the men and women of the community came out of their individual cells, their individual little huts, and came together to hear a sermon together. The men sitting on the right, the women sitting on the left. And some one who had been experienced would deliver a sermon, and this would be every Sabbath. And every seventh Sabbath they would come together, and it would be an all-night meeting, and it wouldn't just be a sermon, but it would be bringing them together to have a communion. A communion of the bread and a little salt, a little hyssop or oil, a little wine. And in this communion together, eventually there would come a chance to sing hymns from their visions individually. They would have found ways to express it in terms of sacred hymns. We have one of those hymns. It's called the Hymn of Jesus, translated by G.R.S. Meade. This is the kind of hymn that the therapeutae, that Jesus and his people would have been making on every Jubilee. Thou sawest me as suffering and seest. Thou didst not stand, but was moved wholly, moved to be wise. Thou hast me for a couch, rest thou upon me. Who I am, thou shalt know when I depart. What now I am seen to be, that I am not. But what I am, thou shalt see when thou comest. If thou hadst known how to suffer, thou wouldest have power not to suffer. Know then how to suffer, and thou hast power not to suffer. That which thou knowest not, I myself will teach thee. I am thy God, not the betrayer's. I would be kept in time with holy souls. In me know thou the word of wisdom. Say thou to me again, glory to thee, Father. Glory to thee, Word. Glory to thee, Sophia. But as for me, if thou wouldst know what I was, in a word, I am the Word, who did play or dance all things, and was not shamed at all. 'Twas I who leaped and danced. But do thou understand all, and understanding say, glory to thee, Father. Amen. And then having danced these things, they would go their separate ways back into meditation, back into contemplation, as it was called. The source of this is Philo's The Contemplative Life. A firsthand, he had been there to those communities. He had seen it himself. And we have the books in Greek. They're unedited by any committees to exercise any of the censorship that so much of the rest of the documents have had. But it's peculiar. It's peculiar because in that healing, or we should now say curing, in that curing, the process was one that was truly alchemical. It was a change of nature, a change of form. Because the curing of souls cannot be done by the mind. It cannot be done by the psyche. It can only be affected by the spirit. And the peculiar reality of the spirit is that it is only one. Jesus says, I do nothing myself. I do only as the Father does. Is the Father through me doing it? The importance is to be able to open up 100%, completely. And that's a perfection. It's a perfection of completeness to be able to open up completely. Then it's not so much a working through you, but what is real occurs. There's no movement. It's effortless, and it is eternal. How is it not going to be? It's only the mind that imagines in its polarized equivocation that life and death are different. One reads between the lines, when Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, he didn't tiptoe in. He said, you think he is dead?
and waded through the people and called out to Lazarus, "Lazarus, get up. Who thinks you're dead? Where is death?" And Lazarus came out trembling, because it's an illusion. The mind's, the psyche's illusion that such a thing as death could exist. Where is it going to exist other than in the mind, other than in the psyche? Lazarus, get up. St. John tells Lycomedes that Cleopatra can't possibly be dead, that if he has the purity of spirit and he calls out to her in just the right way, she will be there. But Lycomedes cannot bring himself to that, and he dies of a heart attack and he falls down. And a great crowd has come around St. John. And the whole population of Ephesus is running in, and this is headline news, going to be in the mouth and ears of everybody the next day. And St. John calls out to Jesus. He says, "This is a moment. This is a moment." And he opens himself up and goes into the Spirit. And he goes over and he brings Cleopatra, not so much back from death, but lets her reoccur in the presence of life. And she gets up trembling, like Lazarus. She thought she was gone. And when she gets up and she sees her husband, Lycomedes, lying, quote, dead on the floor, she is completely, almost gone again. And St. John tells her, "We have been through these lessons. You know how to do this. This power, which is not a power, but is a presence, is communicated directly to me, directly to you. There's no intermediary. You go and raise your husband." And he says, "Remember that the key to it is to open yourself up to the presence 100%. And she goes in, trembling. It says in the Acts of John that she was just trembling, her lip with tears. And she goes and she addresses him, and Lycomedes is raised back up from the dead by his wife, who herself just minutes before was dead. And the population of Ephesus just absolutely stunned by this. And it was on that occasion that St. John went to the great temple of Artemis and took the power away from that old oracle. We have in the Gnostic texts, we have a lot of evidence that what Jesus did was took a third of the power away from the old power structures, from the old demonic structures, and left them in an asymmetric, wobbling weakness that eventually they fell of their own tinker toy, fragile structure. In the Acts of John, after this has happened, one of the people who saw this had a portrait painted of St. John and hung it in his bedroom. And in the Acts of John, St. John happened to be in this bedroom and saw this portrait of a human being, and he said, "You know, we don't have any icons. We have the presence of the light. We don't have this sort of thing." And the man said, "But Master, it is you." And St. John, in the Acts of St. John, had never seen his face. "This is no face. What is this?" And he looked into a bowl of water where you wash, and he could see the likeness, and gently chided the man. Then, having understood, he said, "This is not me. That is not you. Put the picture away. We don't need that. The presence is what is real. When we are cured, then we are that way." This was the essential quality of reality that was brought by Jesus back to Jerusalem, back to Judea. It was not found there, but it was abrogated because it was brought back in like a fresh wind off the desert. the sweetness of pure sunshine and fresh air, the very qualities that the Therapeutai community was famed for around Lake Mariotis, its weather very much like Santa Barbara or La Jolla. It's this kind of a quality, then, that Jesus brings back and brings into play, brings into historical play. And the significance of Christ in Alexandria becomes one where we have to almost strain ourselves to understand. When St. Peter died, was martyred in Rome, his secretary was a young man named John Mark. The Gospel according to Mark is by this individual. And John Mark, who had been unable to accompany Paul, the personality of Paul, the interpretive structure of Paul, seemed to him to be of the old order. Yes, it was interesting, it was close, it was approximate, but it wasn't the real presence, because John Mark had experienced the real presence. And so when Peter was martyred, his notes, his notebooks, his details that he had written down, his stories, his transmission, went to John Mark, and John Mark went to Alexandria, and the Christian church in Alexandria was founded by John Mark. And the Christian church in Alexandria is very interesting. Alexandria as a city, enormous city, about 2 million people, was divided up into 12 sections, just like the old tribes. 12 sections, and each section of Alexandria had in its population the democratic, let's use that term, the democratic right to have a representative of the people, and those 12 met together. And those 12 meeting together, they were called presbyters. And it was those 12 meeting together that was the council of elders, and it was the church that was the focus of those 12. And the church was nothing other than the community of the whole population. And in order to train people to get away from the Roman mind, from the old Torah mind, from the Hellenistic, Persian, smeared, Greek, ambiguous mind, they developed a new kind of education and a new place of education. They called it the catechetical school in Alexandria. That's where it first started. It was the very first Christian university. And the first really great head of it was a man named Pantaeus. Pantaeus had gone to India. He had gone all over the known classical world and had brought back with him a gospel which was written in Hebrew that he found in India and had it translated back into the Greek, the Koine of the Alexandrian day. And Pantaeus trained Clement of Alexandria, who became the next head of the catechetical school. And the Christian church then became extraordinarily effective in a very quiet way, because instead of being based upon the idea of empire and authority, which then Roman authorities could control, as long as your power structure, then a higher power structure can control you. They won't touch you then. We know what you're doing, and eventually we can buy you out, or we can get controlling interest, or we can bait you to come to our corporation. As long as you're a corporation, the corporation mind does not mind. You're just competition. But when you have an effective alternative reality which is undercutting the whole power basis, then you're a danger. Then you're jeopardizing their very functioning mode.
And the Christian church in Alexandria was not at all based on the old Torah or on the Roman law. It was creating liberated, freed, cured individual spirits who were like little flames of integrity that you couldn't manipulate them. How are you going to manipulate them? And not only that, without having any kind of external structure except a communion every seventh day and a special communion every seventh Sabbath, that's the only organization they had. They recognize each other, and they seem to be distinctive because they're kind to each other, they're balanced. And in a Roman world where the mind, the psyche, was haunted to an extent that we can only appreciate today, we're the only people since that time can appreciate how haunted the mind can become. We are unbelievably like they were. You know, the great historian Livy wrote in Cicero's day, about 55 BC, he said, we can no longer stand ourselves, nor can we stand the cure needed. We're caught in a limbo, and after 250 years, it had completely decimated the people. So the emperor Severus, Septimius Severus, from the African province, the Roman Empire, ordered that the Christian church in Alexandria be confiscated. These people be thrown out. They're a jeopardy to us. Not only are they doing it in Alexandria, but this is spreading throughout the empire. And it was all right as long as they were sort of renegade Jewish communities, because the early Christians worshipped in the synagogues. They were just like Jews, another sect of Jews. Well, that's fine. That's all they are. But these people in Alexandria, the Alexandrian Christians, were different. You couldn't control their actions. You couldn't control their community. They tried to control the catechetical school and the church, and they found that there was nobody to control. Because Clement said, we're not in charge, God is in charge. And it's not so much that he's in charge as that he is here. And we'll be glad to help you to find out. Just sit down and we'll work together. They didn't like this. I mean, this was worse. This was worse than any possible thing. Because one thing the ego cannot stand is the truth. Because it realizes that one of us has got to go. If they're right, then we are really wrong. And if we're wrong, then the whole structure that is built upon this is wrong. And it's like that earthquake when integrity comes in and you get that feeling in the pit, the Manipura chakra, that something is basically wrong. And this is what the Christians in Alexandria were producing, that feeling of revulsion among those pagans. We have a document, which is just really a page, from the Mar Saba Monastery, you know, just outside of Jerusalem, before you get down to the Dead Sea in the wilderness there. The Kedron River cuts a gorge down to the Dead Sea, a very steep gorge. And I'm clinging almost like a wasp nest on the side of one of these gorges overhanging the abyss was the monastery of Mar Saba. Herman Melville went there when he had his spiritual trauma in 1876. And in his great epic poem, Clairol, there are great descriptions of the dark lightning solitudes of Mar Saba. The library in Mar Saba had been ransacked again and again by museums and universities, and Professor Morton Smith was there in the 1950s, and he was making a final catalog of what was left in the library of Mar Saba, the old manuscripts, and he found on the back of a page that was just colloquial account keeping was written something in very, very archaic Greek. And when he made a translation for himself, he was shocked to find
that this was a page from a secret Gospel of Mark. Nobody had ever seen it. Nobody had ever heard of it. It wasn't part of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It wasn't part of the Nag Hammadi material. It was like some arrow out of the blue. And Smith's scholarly edition is published by Harvard University Press. Came out in 1973. Clement of Alexandria and a Secret Gospel of Mark. It's a letter from Clement to a man named Theodore. And Clement is trying to tell Theodore in this letter that the cure of souls, spirituality, is quite distinctly different. It is a different process from mental organization, from psychic computation, that those are extraneous. They have absolutely nothing to do with the spirit. They're the conveniences and the adjustments that deluded people make to stay in the world. If you're superstitious enough to keep checking your chart to see where you are, then you're not being present where you are, that sort of thing. That the spirit is different. It's a presence. It's a presence of what? It's a presence of the unity of the all. That's the real. And Clement is saying in this letter that we have a tradition in Alexandria which comes directly down from the Master. And that we know it's efficacious because we practice it. And that that practice originated with him. And like its confirmation is just like the touching of hands all the way through. That there's a waterfall of presence of the divine that comes right through the generations. And that we are in the living tradition. And how do we know? Because we can not only receive it, we can not only experience it, but we can pass it on. And he says, this is what we do in Alexandria. It's a living flame of light, of love. And this is what is coursing through the generations, coursing through what's supposed to be the categories of life and death, the so-called periods of time, the so-called extensions of space, the so-called realms of the mind. That purification is actually making opaque and finally translucent and finally clear all of those compartmentalizations, all of those categorizations. And when the universe becomes completely cleared like that, one can see that there are no barriers whatsoever anywhere. Where are they going to be? They were only delusions in the mind. There were no constellations in the heavens. The universe is a whole. It is a one. That the equivocation of the mind that always saw things in terms of identity, one equals one, was itself a delusionary process. That it was never one equals one. It was one over one. It was a ratio, a rationality, and one over one is one. It's a unity, a unitas. That's what was alive in Alexandria because it had been there from the beginning. It had been focused and brought together by him and radiated out in that brilliant fashion of his. And the distortions that have happened that come down to us are monumental. And when we look at the Gospel of Philip, one of the Nag Hammadi people, it says in here, some say Mary conceived by the Holy Spirit. They are in error. They do not know what they are saying. When did a woman ever conceive by a woman? Because the Holy Spirit was Sophia, it was feminine. Mary is the virgin whom no power defiled. She is a great anathema to the Hebrews who are the apostles and the apostolic men. The virgin whom no power defiled. The powers defile themselves. And the Lord would not have said, my Father who is in heaven, unless he had had another father. He would simply have said, my Father. The Gospel of Philip in the Nag Hammadi material is very disquieting. One finds statements that are quite unusual. And, for instance, the Eucharist is Jesus, for he is called in Syriac Pharasatha, which is the one who is spread out. For Jesus came crucifying the world. It's not that he is crucified, but that the delusionary world is put to the refining fire and is changed and transformed. The Lord went into the dye works of Levi. He took 72 different colors. 72. 6 times 12. It was the 72 who made the translation of the original Old Testament into Greek. They call it the Septuagint. He took 72 different colors, threw them into the vat. He took them all out white. All of the colors, the coat of many colors, came out purified, white. White like in pure light. Not polarized light like electricity, but coherent light like a laser, but like a spiritual coherence. Came out white. And he said, even so has the Son of Man come as a dyer into the world. As for wisdom, who is called the barren, she is the mother of the angels. And the companion of the Savior is Mary Magdalene. But Christ loved her more than all the disciples and used to kiss her often on the mouth. The rest of the disciples were offended by it and expressed disapproval. They said to him, "Why do you love her more than all of us?" And the Savior answered and said to them, "Why do I not love you like her? When a blind man and one who sees are both together in the darkness, they're no different from one another. But when the light comes, he who sees will see the light, and he who is blind will remain in the darkness." Just a few excerpts from the Gospel of Philip, just a few excerpts from a whole new range of material which is available. But it isn't the material that's available that's important, because we have, from the crest of our wave of anxiety, looking back upon those contemporaries of ours in Alexandria 2,000 years ago, we have the capacities to experience presence within ourselves. If we can only find some way to tie the mind, the psyche, into a bow, to stop tying it into knots and hope that somehow we're going to be able to climb out of this world by tying the mind into ever sophisticated knots of becoming metaphysically clever and sophisticated and having ever more clever knots to climb out of this, that whole process is bereft of any reality. There's nothing in that. There is only the experience of that real presence which courses through us because it's there. No one need put it there. No one need make it be there. It is there. The Gospel of Thomas says, "Split the rock, I am there." It's not a metaphor. So Christ in Alexandria becomes for us on Hanukkah today, 1985, an interesting little bow around the little finger. That such is real and exists, and we have a right to speak the truth and live it. Thank you very much, friends.